Guys, welcome back to the Perpetua podcast. It is your host here, James Rankin, and I am delighted today to be joined by Dr. Ed Caddy. Ed, how's it going, mate?
Pretty good. As I was alluding to, it's been a nice day here in England for first one in a while, actually. So just been out doing a little jog and then I'm back to chat. But yeah, I'm not too bad. I think I'm probably better off than most doctors at the moment.
Good. Savage, man. So perfect. Tell the people a little bit about yourself. So you're a doctor. Tell us everything you think we should know.
I have a bit of a wandering odd CV. It's not too strange, but I studied biochemistry many years ago. That was like 2009. So I did a full degree. I thought I was going to go and do a PhD, and then I realized I liked science, but I'm interested in humans as opposed to just test tubes and petri dishes and that kind of thing. So I went to work with children with special needs in the interim before getting into medicine. And then I went over to study at Queen's, which is probably how we have a link, because obviously I'm English, but I went over there to study and made a lot of good friends and got involved in the fitness industry over there. You've had Martian on your podcast and we became good friends when I was there. Got through medical school, but I think even in the fitness industry, we have a different perspective that we see health on, right? It's in medicine, we're very much somebody has an illness or a disease, they come and see us and we try and deal with the symptoms of that illness or disease. And I've always been of the mindset, what can we do to make your health better? So then we don't need to worry about the illness or disease. So that mindset got me into looking at different alternative and complementary therapies. I listened to a few podcasts, Ben Greenfield. I don't know if your listeners would be a fan of his or know of his, but he kind of talks to different doctors.
He's the biohacker guy, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a crazy guy that does guinea pig experiments. but he has so much money that he can, and he's a cool guy. It's interesting. I've just seen that he does his podcasts walking now on a treadmill. So it's really odd when you listen to it because he's slightly out of breath the whole time and it stands. So I'm not doing that yet.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll do that either.
So then he had a few guests on. Actually, I think it probably started a bit before that. I listened to Charles Poliquin.
Nice.
He was on Tim Ferriss's podcast, and he was always a bit of a renegade in the fitness world. Some people really liked him and some people didn't, but he had some good stuff. And he was very, functional in his approach. And he had some opinions about medical problems that I thought were interesting. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my first rabbit hole. I got into him. And then I think through him, I was introduced to Klokov. And then I eventually got into CrossFit through being interested in big Russian guy.
Nice.
And yeah, it was just, it's all kind of come to a point where lots of my interests aligned. And I listened to a podcast episode on Ben Greenfield with a doctor called Dr. Ted. So not Dr. Ed, but Dr. Ted. Dr. Ted Achikoso. And he is essentially a ridiculous doctor who has an IQ of 210. And I think he's one of the top 10 smartest people ever tested. And has a CV even more ridiculous than mine. And he's come up with this new framework for health. So that's the lens I always had kind of got well defined by the way he works. And on the side of that, I've been studying movement with Julian and Richard from StrongFit. And I'm trying to create a practice myself where they come together. So that's nice. Where we are. And on the side, I'm an NHS doctor working with COVID.
On the side. I like it, man. I think that's fantastic because the doctors that I've met are like typically they do the sort of things that you said there, where it's like you see the symptom, you treat the symptom, you try and nullify that,
yeah,
and then off you go on your way. Whereas probably how I came to find out about you and how I developed a relationship with Marcin as well was I see symptoms and I try and figure out what's the problem from this and how do we then step back from there. And so that's what attracted me to someone like yourself, where you have that similar lens to me in that sense, but then you also have this fantastic background of you're a fucking NHS doctor, and it's so unique to pair those two things together, which probably shouldn't be. Elephant in the room, what's the story with the red light behind you here? Tell everyone about it. For the people who are listening, Ed is in a room and he is completely red. He looks like he's Deadpool or something like this. Yeah. So tell everyone about it. What's the benefits? Why are you doing it?
Yeah. So I'll prefix this with, I've been trying to think about what my true interest is and how I frame and talk about health. And I think the number one thing is bioenergetics, which essentially means how we use and move energy around our body. And that kind of encompasses everything. And I think the way you can think about that is if your car doesn't turn on, it's usually a problem with the electrical bit or the engine. Back in the olden days, if your car didn't turn on, it was probably not enough fuel in there, right? Because they just burnt fuel. And they didn't have to worry about the electrical bit or the engine bit because they were pretty simple. And that was kind of taken care of by evolution. So thinking about bioenergetics is how well can we produce energy? And one of those things a lot of people think, when they think about energy, they think about food, but that's actually the fuel that you put in the engine, which makes the electrics run properly. But the red light. So we have little engines in our cells called mitochondria. Mm-hmm. I won't get too fancy, but essentially these collect protons and electrons from our food and they move them along. They create water and they create ATP. So the red light, there's studies that show that the little motor that creates ATP runs at 100% efficiency when there is red light frequencies present. Oh. And other parts in that electron transport chain run much more efficiently. They work much better when the red light's present. The problem with the modern world, and this is where we get into the conversation about imbalances and deficiencies and toxicities and those are the things that I'm interested in. But in the modern world, we spend a lot of time around blue light, either from our screens or the windows, say, next to you, they block the majority of the red frequencies of the sun. So even if you think you're in natural light, you're in unnatural light. So the imbalance caused by modern day living is we get lots of blue frequencies of light and we don't get enough red. And it's something that we don't really think about in general. And this is why I like to talk about it, because I like to talk about things that other people aren't thinking about, because then somebody gets interested and they'll go away and find out about it for themselves. But there was a paper that was written by one of the lead researchers in red light therapy, which is called in the literature, they call it photobiomodulation, which just means using light as therapy, or low-level laser therapy. And they've shown that you can improve things like Parkinson's by shining it directly through the skull. You can improve recovery from heart attacks by, weirdly enough, if you shine it on your leg where the bone marrow is, you produce stem cells and that heals your heart after having a heart attack. Or for the bros, you can use it pre-workout to kind of like pre-treat a muscle, get it working efficiently. And then I think the papers show that you have faster recovery from those muscle groups. Use it. So on the flip side, there's loads of data to show that the blue light, especially after sunset, and early in the morning as well, before the sun's come up, is really damaging to us. So things like breast cancer, Alzheimer's, all of these things that are plaguing our hospitals could have a part to play with light. And I think eventually they'll probably show that blue light might be as damaging, if not more, than smoking.
Wow.
Yeah.
So for people who don't know, examples of blue light include what, your phone, your laptop, your TV?
Phone, yeah. There's an interesting fact. I don't know if it's true, but apparently the original cable for an iPhone was annoyingly slightly too short. And that was because they didn't want people to have it next to their bed when they were sleeping.
Wow. Well, Steve Jobs was notoriously anti his own stuff. Like, apparently he wouldn't let his kids have an iPad.
Right.
Because he knew of the dangers of being sucked in by, like, because they were developing these things to make people use it and use it and use it. And right. So he just straight away didn't let his children have an iPad. Apparently.
Yeah.
Which just goes to show, like, he has the claim to fame with it, and he was like, whoa, I love you. You're not using this.
Yeah. And that's how did he die? He's from pancreatic cancer. And where is your laptop? It's like here, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that may not be the cause, but it may have been a contributing factor. The other thing, you mentioned about the reason why people keep going back to their phones and keep going back to their screens is because this is something I got from Jack Cruz, who's kind of like a very forward thinking. He calls himself a quantum biologist. He's a neurosurgeon in America, but he taught me all of this stuff about light. But he, my mind's gone blank there where I was going.
Jack Cruz. Is he American as well? Yeah.
He is, yeah. It'll come back to me in a second.
It's okay. We can come back to it. Let's kind of dip into then. You had mentioned like toxicity and dysfunction and imbalances and all this kind of stuff. What are the things that you're seeing most common amongst just general population people? Like, what are the big things? What are the biggest issues?
So I probably mentioned light as number one.
Okay.
And along with that is getting outside. And it's not a great time generally in the world for promoting the idea of spending as much time outside as you possibly can, because that's where we came from in the first place and where we're designed to work best, because the engines are working properly and we're supposed to be exposed to the elements. We're not supposed to have air conditioning all the time or heating on. We're supposed to maybe get a bit cold and maybe a bit too hot.
Yeah.
Which kind of feeds into the idea of doing things like ice baths and hard training, because we build resilience by doing those things rather than protecting ourselves all the time. So yes. And then, one in the movement world would be a lot of sitting down as opposed to standing up. But that's a bit of a simplistic idea. I think just generally moving rather than being sedentary, would be a big one too. And then, nutrition wise, we can probably go down to a big rabbit hole. I don't know. It might be a too long conversation, but, eating the wrong types of foods and not eating enough of the right types of foods is the simple way to say it. And I think it probably catches most of the points that are important. Eating too many processed foods and not eating enough organic foods. And you can go into arguments about whether we need meat or don't need meat. And I think if you don't need meat, if you don't eat meat, then you probably need a bit of meat. And if you eat loads of meat, then you probably need a bit of plant life as well. But every case is very individual, and it's kind of a discussion I like to have. And this is where I suppose I differ in my thinking. Most of the studies we do in medicine look at what's best for the population, and they're very quantitative, and they're looking for how many more months or years of life, for example, would something give somebody. Whereas my approach is very qualitative, in that I'm looking for how much quality of life can we give by a very individualized approach. And within that individualized approach is understanding these imbalances, deficiencies, and subtle toxicities.
Yeah, I'd probably be with you on that, because I don't particularly want to live to 100 if from my 80th birthday to my 100th, I'm incapacitated and I can't really do anything. Like, I'd rather live a really fulfilled life where I can do, to a degree, whatever I want, whenever I want.
Yeah.
Until I'm 80.
Mm.
And then if you were to say, well, you're going to spend the majority of your time in a chair, incapable of getting up, you can't really feed yourself, you can't wash yourself, you can't look after yourself, then that's not really, the quality of life there has diminished to childish levels where you're fully reliant on someone. So I'd be with you on that. So let's dive down the nutrition rabbit hole. I think that would be good fun. I've not really spoke about that on a lot of my podcasts. It's mm-hmm. something that I probably struggle with my clients, because everybody wants a meal plan. Everybody wants their calories set out for them. Everybody wants what's the right amount of protein, what's the right amount of this and that and whatever. And I think that we'll have a similar thought on this. I also think that you'll be able to articulate it a bit better than me. So no pressure. So what are your, like you've mentioned there, non-processed organic foods. Like someone comes to you and they are unhealthy, what are your interventions? How are we getting them back on track?
Yeah, well, I wonder if Martin talked about this when he was on with you.
Absolutely. We gently kissed on it. I told Martin whenever the podcast finished, I said, man, we're getting back on in another couple of months, because like I said to you at the start, I have a list here of things I want to cover. And with Marcin, I think we got into 3 of about 10 things that I had written down. And so,
yeah,
let's, you can cover nutrition for Marcin.
Well, we have a similar thought process towards it. I guess mine's a bit expanded towards covering medical bases in some cases, but the first thing when thinking about, for me, thinking about anything, again, it goes back to, are the electrics running properly and is the engine running well? And that is the nervous system in good health? And are the mitochondria, are they getting enough rest, and are they getting enough fuel? Mm-hmm. And the first way to address both of those things is through sleep, because that's when your nervous system rests and that's when your engines are rebuilt. And that's how I think about it. So the first thing I would tend to do with clients is to ask them nicely to remove carbohydrates from their evening meal, and mostly sugars. And the reason for that is because if we think of the two sides of the nervous system, being the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system, which a lot of people think that the sympathetic nervous system uses a lot of energy and the parasympathetic doesn't really, but really it's energy spent towards the outside world versus energy spent towards the inside world. So when you have to digest something like a steak, your body is forcing you to spend energy towards the inside of you, which is what happens overnight. That's when all the regeneration happens. So you're providing all of those building blocks, essentially, for things to start to regenerate. So the problem with adding carbohydrates at that period, for some people, maybe not all people, is that the carbohydrates and the sugars, they stimulate an arousal response, which leads to an increased sympathetic nervous system activity, which can then push you back towards wanting to spend energy outside and prevent you from digesting the protein well.
Right.
So usually that can have quite a big impact on somebody if they don't change anything else. Just removing carbs from their evening and eating enough protein, and they can have fats with that and vegetables, to help them get a nice deep sleep without being awoken at the, so when you eat carbs, you suppress your adrenaline, and that takes about 3 hours, and then you get a spike again. So a lot of people will wake up 3 hours after they go to sleep. And that's usually the point that you produce growth hormone. So if you're training hard and want to build muscle, then it may not be a good idea for you to be eating a load of carbohydrates before you sleep. If you buy into this way of thinking about the nervous system, which I've seen work really well. And when you think about how these things work, it's always good to look at the most extreme examples. And the most extreme is a friend of mine, essentially, who suffered from severe anxiety and panic attacks. He's actually a CrossFit, to the point where he couldn't enter the gym without having a panic attack, so he couldn't train. And he used this diet protocol by putting his protein in the evening to help him sleep through the night, and putting the carbs and fats through the day to energize his engines, essentially. And by doing this, he went from 12 years on two very strong anti-anxiety medications to no medications within 6 months.
Wow.
And if you know anything about those medications, people don't generally stop them ever. Yeah, once you start them, you're kind of stuck. So there, I like to talk about this because it kind of catches a lot of interesting points in one. One of my purposes is to help people realize that a lot of the things that they're suffering with or conditions they find themselves in are reversible. You have to deal with the electrics and the engine, and then things generally move in the right direction from there.
So with that, with like protein and carb and fat consumption,
yeah,
if you're trying to keep your protein to the evening, does that mean like during the day when you're having your carbs and your fats, are you trying to avoid protein or just keep intake to an absolute minimum?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I think, so talking to people who have like normal desk jobs, for example, and they eat a big meal in the middle of the day and they have 2 hours where they can't function and they're like completely zonked out.
That's sluggish.
Now, if you ask a CrossFitter the same question or somebody that trains, like, would you want to eat something that makes you feel lethargic and sluggish before you train? Probably not, right? This is one of those things that you kind of have to work out for yourself where your tolerances lie. But through the day, I tend to not like eat large meals. Like I'll have quite a bit of fat for breakfast, from whatever source I fancy, and then maybe some vegetables and dark chocolate and something for lunch, but like, I don't really have many calories, so to say. Once your engines and your electrics work well, then building muscle and improving your performance comes much more easily than you can think. And it takes a lot of the conversation away from calories and macro counting, really, towards, do you feel good? And do you think, I mean, you can just eat a bit more and feel a bit better. Yeah. There's lots of, like, some people do really well on the carnivore diet, for example. And there's people using it in clients and patients with autoimmune disease. Jordan Peterson would be a good example of that. And you can more think about those. I prefer to frame it again in the lens of how is that impacting the nervous system. And if somebody is constantly anxious, which we know Jordan Peterson is, that kind of personality where they're constantly super ready to have an argument or give their points, then suppressing that by giving them meat all day long, making them feel a tiny bit more lethargic, is probably what they need to function in the day. Whether that's optimal and whether there's something that needs to be done about the issue in the first place, perhaps, but this is why everything comes back to the individual.
That's really interesting, because since this lockdown, like in the Republic of Ireland, we've been locked down now since the new year. And January has been my most productive work month. It's allowed me to do things I wanted to do. I've been consistent in my output. My training's been going really well. I'm getting stronger. I'm getting fitter. And I'm not having to do that much to do it.
Yeah.
And what you kind of said there really struck me. Was you were like, whenever things are running well, you don't need to do that much. Yeah. And what I wanted to ask you was about things like fasting. But I typically, like yourself, don't eat much during the day. Like today, what time is it? It's 11 o'clock. I've had a bowl of blueberries and that's it. And a coffee and a ton of water. I'll have some oats or something maybe at about 12 because I want to train at about 2. And I'll not eat again tonight until about 6 or 7. But I'll eat big meal, steak, veggies. I'll probably have some potatoes with that as well. But enough to like where I will crash afterwards and I'll be real sluggish for the rest of the evening. And that's fairly typical of me for the past month. So my general calorie intake is probably half what it was.
Yeah.
There's days where I eat more, there's days where I eat that, and like it does fluctuate. But my body composition, my muscle mass, strength, all of that is better than it was, even though I'm not trying as hard. But like you said, I'm getting 8 hours sleep every day, minimum. I read before going to bed instead of watching Netflix.
Uh-huh.
I read when I get up instead of looking at my phone. Like I've started to implement all these things without clicking, without me realizing that they're all coming together and they're actually really fucking beneficial. That's mad. Wow.
Yeah. So I had this conversation with somebody yesterday, actually. Like, I don't think it's useful to think about being like, there's not really like a bedtime and a waking up time. Like when everything starts to run well, it's just a cycle of like, yeah, part of your day is asleep.
Yeah.
You have to make sure the bit when you're not asleep is productive and useful. Otherwise you struggle to sleep. And we all feel like I'm sure a lot of people struggle to sleep going into lockdown because their activity levels during the day dropped so much. And if you can't push your activity high enough during the day, then your body doesn't feel like it needs to spend the energy to recover yourself. But that's essentially how I structure my diet as well. The things that concern me is people that feel that they have to force themselves to do things to be healthy, because the mindset of having to force yourself to do something to be healthy is counterintuitive to me. It should be a natural thing to be healthy, right?
Yeah.
And I think people also mistake. I mean, in some cases you have to make some sacrifices if you want to be at the top of your game, but you don't necessarily have to sacrifice on too much health if you want to push the performance really high.
Yeah. I completely agree. That again, that's really interesting. I spoke to a few clients recently being like, if you're concerned about being healthy and you're stressing about how you're not being healthy, you're not going to get healthier by stressing about it.
Yeah.
Like there has to be that step away from it and just kind of go, right, I'm going to do these things. If these things don't happen, okay, I'll try again tomorrow. I'll try again next week. And just, it has to be effortless and just flow. I kind of wanted to ask you then as well, just staying on nutrition, about fasting and extended periods of time without eating.
Yeah.
Yes, no, maybe, should we do it? Is it pointless? Does it help?
Again, in the right context. There's a really interesting paper by a guy called Walter Longo, who's one of the leading experts in fasting, who showed that, for example, if in his chemotherapy patients, if they fasted for 72 hours prior to getting their chemotherapy, they would have less side effects and better outcomes from the chemotherapy.
Wow.
Now, it was a pilot trial, but the biology and the basic theory and hypotheses behind it makes a lot of sense, because all of the cells that die because of chemo are tend to be the ones that turn over quickly, which like your hair or the lining of your gut, which is why you get nasty nausea and all of these horrible symptoms. Mm-hmm. By fasting, you're slowing everything down. You're preventing the cells turning over really rapidly. So you can kind of suppress that response by doing the fasting. What was really interesting is after 48 hours, all of the immune system was completely down. And then in that 72 hours, the last day of fasting, it like shot back up and it was repopulated by almost a completely different set of cells. Wow. So it's a really cool way of resetting your stem cells. It would be, again, I'm not giving medical advice, but if I had an autoimmune condition or if I had an issue that I wasn't sure what was causing it, then I would probably try that, because you have to try these things. If you're the kind of person that I am, I like to try everything that I do. And I say that I will never ask somebody, a client or a patient, to do anything that I've never done personally before. So I tried a 72-hour fast in the summer. I did it when I was at work, which is probably silly. even my consultant was like, oh, that's really impressive. It's really powerful for treating things like fatty liver disease. You can make some big progress just in 3 days. Or
wow.
And the way that I structure the diet with the protein towards the end of the day means if you want to fast through the day, then go for it. And sometimes it's a really good way of getting people to be active in the day, because they're like, I don't want to think about food. I have to fast and do stuff. And then you start to push that activity in the day up. They can crash with the protein and then they can sleep better at night. So it's good for kind of setting the tone of the rhythm. And then it's probably good to do. My thinking is that I find it difficult to transition between seasons with my diet. I quite like to eat seasonally if I can, mm-hmm. At least to the vegetables and fruits that are around and maybe the fats that I eat too. And I find that quite a difficult process to go through. And that probably relates to the different bacteria in our guts that regulate our behavior and how we feel about what we eat. So maybe by fasting, we can make that transition more easily, because the bacteria are kind of like, oh, don't know what to do, so we'll just die. And then we can repopulate them with maybe more reliable ones. But going back to the basic principles of how I see things, we evolved in nature. So there would have been days where we had food, and there would have been days or maybe weeks without food, and we would have to be constantly searching for it, which is why most people get energized by fasting, because their body's like, this is stressful, we need to go and find food. The problem is, it's not stressful to find food if you can just go to the supermarket, again, another imbalance caused by society is that we always have food when we want it. So maybe you should have like a dice that you roll every morning that says today's fasting. You have no choice.
That's a fucking fantastic idea, man. I love that. Do I eat today? Yes, no, once, twice, three times. Yeah. I'm going to make that.
I've never said that before or thought of it, but there you go. You can have that one.
Oh, yeah, let's do it, man. That's serious. Wow, I love that. Cool. Let's dive into training a little bit as well then. So you talked about CNS and is your central nervous system ready for training? And that obviously has a big factor whenever it comes to strength training and endurance training and all that sort of stuff. Like, how do you structure your training?
Yeah.
And what do you recommend for other people as well then?
Again, back to the electrics and the engine, right? So I try and make my training balanced, but I try and, for me, training is a complement to my life.
Sorry to interrupt. I say this all the time. Training has to complement your life. Unless you are a professional athlete, in which case training is your life. if training's getting in the way or you're stressing about it, you're fucking doing it wrong. I think I've used those exact words on maybe half the podcasts that I've done. So that is fantastic. I knew we were on the same page, man. I knew it. I'm delighted.
I will throw a caveat in there. Is there should be at least one day a week or maybe one day every 2 weeks where you are afraid to train and stress about it because it you know it's going to be a really difficult session. And that goes back to not being afraid of being cold or not having any food.
Like resilience.
We have to train that part of our body. So I think of training in two ways. So going back to the complimenting thing. So I was speaking to my friend the other day, one of my business partners, and saying how because when this second wave of COVID came, I was moved from the GP practice I was working in to work in the COVID ward. And your nervous system responds to your environment. And obviously when you're in a hospital, there's the quite reasonable chance that you're going to be called to an emergency and have to do something in quite a high stress situation. And that it does change the way you respond to stress. So when I structure my training, it usually revolves around how do I need to be able to perform for that day, or do I need to recover from the previous days at work, or do I need to prepare myself for work? Or for example, what do I do before I'm a bit nervous about going on a podcast? I'll do a light jog, just get my mind flowing a bit and get my body flowing, but not stress about like doing it for a certain amount of time or like reps or sets, or like, I don't worry about the data. I'm very subjective in my approach. Because it my job is very much, it tells me what to do and I don't like to be told what to do. So then I think about training. This is how I think about me and for other people as well, training the hardware and the software of our body. So I talked about the electrics and the engine. They're basically the same two words. One's the hardware, one's the software. So with the engine, when we exercise, again, this goes against what most people believe, but when we exercise, the main fuel for our muscles is lactate. It's not glucose, it's not amino acids, it's not anything else. For our muscles is lactate. And I'm actually writing a scientific paper on this at the moment with a psychiatrist to explain how lactate influences the nervous system and how the nervous system influences lactate and how this links to me feeling more anxious or more relaxed doing different activities like work or whatever. And my thought process is that we can use this information as coaches and programmers to help people individually with how they respond to stress in their job. And that's why it complements my job, right? So there's two ends of the spectrum. One is, can we produce lactate? And the other one is, can we oxidize it? So doing those slow runs that I just did, that would be oxidizing it, makes me feel more relaxed. The other side of that was how much can we produce in a short amount of time, which would be going as hard as you possibly can. In StrongFit, they call it burn the questions, which is essentially how quickly can you murder yourself? And are you truly tired or are you just quitting? And then that brings the question up, and that question kind of pervades all areas of your life, which is why I think everybody should be doing some sort of training, regardless of what your job is or who you are, even if you're elderly. So my parents are in their late 60s. I currently live with them, and I make them do sandbag carries, all of the stuff. And they generally do enjoy it. And then the other side of things is the nervous system. So realizing that the exercises, the strength and conditioning choices that we make are all a product of the muscles that we're using, as opposed to the other way around. So a lot of people will think, like, let's do a squat and assume that a squat involves a certain set of muscles. But really, we're doing an exercise using the muscles, and then the squat is the outcome. People always choose a squat. It's a complex exercise, but it can be made much more simple. And I think you talked about that with one of your guests. I saw a little clip about making it simple, but realizing that a competitive level perfect squat is an outcome, as opposed to using your glutes and your hamstrings to move your body up and down, is a constraint-based system where you're getting what you need. As in, if you want to work your glutes and your hamstrings, then you can use that. Maybe some quads as well.
Yeah.
So I see the body in a very different way to everybody else, in that I talked about the bioenergetics, the flow of the energy through the body. I think about that from all aspects. So that includes movement too. So I believe that you need, it's like a top-down approach. It gets a bit more complex, but you need your upper body to be working well before your lower body works. And you need the midline to be able to connect the two. So most of my training is exploring those concepts and trying to work out, if somebody comes to me with a sore shoulder, why is it sore? And what do I need to do about it? So then I'll do exercises that I'm trying to find out why I'm doing it in that way and how I can change it and which muscles are working and all of these things that maybe people take for granted and don't think about until they have an injury. And then that's when they come and ask you.
Yeah.
But that was a bit of a roundabout way of telling you what I do. Essentially, I just lift a lot of sandbags.
And explore, ask questions.
Yeah.
Savage. Something you kind of touched on there, which I find really interesting, is for you to, before you do work and before you come on a podcast or whatever, and you want to think clearly, you do something aerobic, low and slow and steady.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the challenges I run into with my clients is they look for that burn the question. They want to go hard, fast. They want to be left on the floor going, what the fuck just happened there?
Yeah.
If people are searching for that, like, because I'm the same as you, I do that once, maybe every other week. I did it yesterday and I was fucked for the day, but I knew I wasn't going to train today because I've got calls and I've got programming and that, but I haven't done it in about 3 weeks before that. So if someone's constantly looking for that, what's going on there, in your opinion?
So this is one of the imbalances created, I think, specifically by the fitness industry and by potentially by CrossFit methodology, is that there's a clock and there's lots of people in the room and there's a whiteboard and everyone wants to beat that. And there has to be an education around every day is not a competition with everybody else around you. And it's a difficult conversation to have, but yes, it's a form of anxiety when people constantly want to run themselves into the ground because they're not truly going to the place. They're not going to that dark place because you can't do it every day. If you can kill yourselves 5 days in a row, you haven't killed yourself. You're just slowly running yourself into the ground. And that's the point. Like, it's a really difficult conversation to have, but if you truly want to experience what that is, I think it's much easier to go to that from a time under tension rather than a skill element. So like one of the things that I did recently was carry a sandbag for 400 meters 10 times.
Wow.
So by round three, I didn't want to carry on and I had every excuse. I dropped it halfway. So I wasn't even going like a full distance. And then like every time I would get back to the start point, I'd have like a crisis. And then I'd think about what's the point in training? Why am I doing this? And then your mind starts to change and like, well, no, I can do it. I've just done five. And I'm thinking about why I want to train. So maybe there are answers to pushing myself to that place that maybe initially I didn't want to find, but by pushing myself there, I can find them and ask those questions about what's the point in all of this. Another way is to push a sled really fast until you can't push it anymore. And usually that's defined by the person telling you to keep going, as opposed to you thinking that you can't push it anymore, because usually you can take another step. And that's the same thing with a sandbag, is you can always pick it up and take it a few more steps. It's just whether you want to do that. And that's the true beauty about knowing if you're getting better. Because if you do a different workout every day and you end up lying on the floor, how do you know that you're getting better? If you can walk another step every day and take it all the way back to, say, one of my patients that's unable to walk in a hospital bed, and they can walk two steps on the first day, and then by day five, they can walk 10 steps. Then we know they're better. But they're not going to quit walking just because they've done five, and then they're going to like sit in the bed and do curls, right? They're going to keep walking until they can walk as much as you need to be able to walk. So the question is, how far do you want to walk?
Savage. I love that. Yeah. That's you made a great point there, man. And I think I actually posted it on my Instagram last week when we recorded this. It'll be weeks ago from whenever this is released. But if you're training hard every day, you're never training hard. It's not something that's possible.
And I'm not saying that I'm like the king of training hard, because we all go we all know that we're holding back sometimes, and we think, oh, I could be doing more. And then I went out to Amsterdam to train with Richard and Julian. And there's a whole nother level that you don't think that you can push yourself to, but it's there. It just requires the right probes, I guess. But it's an interesting question as well, because for me as a doctor, we sometimes find ourselves we're very sympathetic to people. In that if somebody's going through struggle, then we're very nice and kind. But sometimes not everybody needs nice, kind people. They sometimes need to be told, no, you need to go and do the workout, rather than, no, it's, yeah, you can just do nothing and sit down all day and wait for it to get better. Because nothing gets better by
just leaving avoiding.
And that's and it's the conversation I've had with colleagues, is especially in GP, when people call up asking for a medication. And there's an education aspect to it that we forget about. The original definition of doctor was teacher. But now it's not so much about that. And that's kind of what I'd like to change. But there is a point where you have to say, no, I'm not doing what I should be doing. It's time to do that.
Yeah. How do you find that? Because what you said there, I truly believe in, and it's something I kind of struggle with. So how do you find that balance of someone is stressed to the hilt, life is really, really hard, you're coaching them, you're trying to help them through this. Where's the line? What's the point? How do we help figure that out? Or is it just through conversation where we go, do you know what? Listen, I know it's hard, but you've got to do it. You've got to go and train. You've got to, like, you can't just keep putting this on the back burner. Where do you go from good cop to bad cop?
You go from good cop to bad cop when you understand your client, and when you are a great coach as opposed to a good coach. So, and that's just like, it's part of the craft of coaching, is being able to read people. But to put it into a more practical framework, when we think about the nervous system, we think about four states. And I don't know if you discussed these with Marchin, being the freeze, flight, fight, and flow. Now, a lot of people are stuck in freeze. That's when they don't want to do anything. When they start to think about whether they should do something or somebody tells them to do something, they might enter the flight state, which is where anxiety is. And they think, oh, shall I enter the fight or shall I just go back to doing nothing? And it's being able to read your client to think, what fight can I give them that will allow them to succeed? Nice. And once people enter that flow state, they produce dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin. That's the people that exercise and say, oh, I feel so much better. Before, I didn't want to work out, and now I feel better. That's what's happening. there are also people who will work out and then tell you that they feel better, but actually they feel worse. And that's, again, it's another element to the story, and being able to understand things like body language and keeping in touch with your clients, like, did they sleep well, that kind of thing. They're all pointers that maybe that workout wasn't for them. But how do you educate somebody to do that themselves is another question. And it's allowing them to feel something. So somebody came to me and they were super stressed out, and they told me that they wanted to scream at everybody. So I told them to do a specific routine that involved very explosive movements. And with every movement, I told them to swear and say the things that they wanted to say to the people. And then they messaged me like half an hour later and said, that was amazing. I feel amazing. And now I can get on with the rest of my day.
Wow.
And I think that, that's to me, that's the point of the gym, is being able to express yourself in a safe place, either physically or emotionally or however, spiritually, however you see it as a coach or person. And that's your job as a gym owner, I guess, is to create that environment where people can express themselves.
100%. Man, I am so in line with you on that. I think that is absolutely deadly. We've just hit the 50-minute mark there. So, bro, I think we'll cut it. We managed to cover 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 of the things I wanted to cover. So, yeah, that's not too bad at all. What I'd actually love to do, and we'll probably have to wait for the world to open up, is I'd love to get you and Marcin on together and have like a big discussion that way. I think, I don't know if the world would be ready for that, but I am. So that's all that really fucking matters here. Like, this podcast is just me talking to people I want to talk to. So yeah.
We have a love-hate
We
have a love-hate relationship, Marcin and I.
Yeah, perfect.
It's usually because he tells me to stop being a pussy.
Quit your bitching. I love that guy. Ed, man, thank you so much. If people want to look you up and find you on the internet, where can they find you?
Yeah, so at the moment, I'm just really on my Instagram account, which is Dr. Ed Caddy. I have started a business, so I'm working with another doctor and another health business coach. So we work with people that are mostly executive CEOs and Olympic athlete level athletes to do all of this health optimization approach. So it's a new thing. So there's no website for it yet, but it's coming. It's called Soma. So we might start our own podcast as well, and maybe have you on.
Savage, man, that'd be great. Let me know whenever your website comes up, because this won't be released for about nearly 2 months. So if you have it up by then, it would be a good one to plug as well.
It might be. I work relatively slowly.
That's good, man. Work at your own pace and get things done and get them done properly. Ed, man, I really, really appreciate it. Guys, as always, if you like this, if you enjoyed it, if you know someone who would find it helpful, please, please, please like, share, all the good stuff. And I will catch you next week.